Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 426. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about hiking and convict history and the plight of the devil as we go to Tasmania. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Before we get into today's interview, let me just remind you that there are still spots available for the trip to Morocco. And one of the reasons that there are spots is we're ending up doing two trips. We're going to do a 15-day trip followed by a 10-day trip. I'm only going on the 10-day trip, just so you know. That might influence you to go on the 15-day trip. And the 15-day trip, I don't have the page up just yet, but it should go up about the same time as this episode. So go to amateurtraveler.com and look on the book travel tab, and I'll have links to both of those trips. I'd like to welcome back to the show Robert Reed, who's come to talk to us about Tasmania. Robert, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And I say welcome back to the show. You now have a new title. You are the offbeat observer for National Geographic Traveler. And I'd have to say that is the best title I've ever heard.
Yeah, I love it. Offbeat observer. I'm waiting for the merch. But yeah, I write for them about offbeat things, often like kind of the philosophy, the why and hows of travel. So not so much this is a great walking destination, which, by the way, Tasmania is, but why do we walk? What does it mean we walk? And these kinds of things. So it's a lot of fun. I get away with a lot of stuff, and it's been going really well.
Excellent. And Robert still has readontravel.com, and we'll talk about that more at the end. But let's first put Tasmania on a map. I'm guessing that the bright listener out there for Amateur Traveler knows where Tasmania is, but just in case they don't, where would we find Van Diemen's Land?
Van Diemen's Land. Tasmania is a name that we recognize because of the Tasmanian devil in the cartoon, at the very least. But it is a bit of a mystery to a lot of people, and a lot of people who do go to Australia once, two, three times from abroad may not even make it there, but it's a place that's kind of rising. It is a heart-shaped island off the southeast coast of Australia, so kind of just straight south of Melbourne, a little bit south of where Sydney is. And it is the furthest south I've ever been, never been to Antarctica. So you're getting way down there when you get to Tasmania. And it's a small place compared to that big monster of Australia above it. It's about the size of Indiana. And it's an island that feels very different from the rest of Australia, which we'll talk about a little.
Excellent. And why did you go? What led you to go to Tasmania?
Well, I had the pleasure of getting to plan some trips to Australia. Anywhere I wanted to go as a correspondent for Tourism Australia. Now, I lived in Melbourne when I was working with Lonely Planet about 10 years ago. And I went around Victoria, that state in the southern part of Australia a little bit, been to Sydney, but I hadn't done too much. So I picked a couple trips. One was to get into the outback of New South Wales. I went to Broken Hill, where a lot of outback films are shot, like Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, Mad Max 2, and all this. But I really wanted to walk. I mean, everyone in Victoria, when I was living there, was talking on and on about this place called Tasmania to the south. And they kind of dream of like getting away and maybe having a cottage there. It's like their Hamptons or something, or to retire there. Or they talked about the walks. They talked about some of the food they get there. And to them, it was just this wonder that always stuck with me. And so when I had a second place that I was looking for, I really wanted to get into Tasmania and understand that. I like the fact that it's more compact. If you look at Australia itself and you think about what it's made of, this big ancient rock that it's built off of, and a lot of people call it the rock there in Australia, but it's essentially almost all dominated by the outback, some of the most kind of inhospitable, harsh landscape that you can imagine. In fact, I look at it as a candy apple, and if you take the caramel or the toffee off the top of a candy apple, like you get at the state fair or something, and you're left with that apple in your hand, that's how much of the outback is Australia. So you think about that massive continent and how much of it is outback, really. It's almost the whole thing. And then you go just down to Tasmania, it really just doubles up what the Australian experience is, in the sense that it's much more green, much more forested and mountains. It's a very, it almost looks a little bit like the Pacific Northwest or the north of England, in a sense. That is, if you don't look too close, mostly because the vegetation and animals are completely another world.
Well, and you mentioned, well, actually, you mentioned Australia, first of all, and I'm longing to get there. I just finished the book just today, A Town Called Alice, so Australia is on my mind. But if we head sort of north in Australia, we get rainforest, but we get tropical rainforest, but you've headed the other direction here, so you're talking about a temperate rainforest.
It's a lot of different things. I mean, you have the myrtle rainforest through parts of Tasmania, and then you get up into like these king billy pines and all these more alpine-like type of things. It gets higher up. So you have a lot of different types of vegetation, a lot of trees that are endemic and plants that are endemic to Tasmania. And it depends on where you are and where you go, but you can get into it. I was reminded of going on the Overland Track, which is a six-day trek we'll talk about a little bit, which is kind of the Appalachian Trail of sorts on a much more smaller scale for Australia and certainly for Tasmania. It's right through the heart of the island. And you're passing on just within hours from moors and like kind of bogs and button grass and kind of, if there weren't places to walk, clearly you would be kind of sunk to your shins. And then you go up through these myrtle forests and over to these ridges, and you see these rock-topped mountains that escaped the Ice Age. They were untouched, part of these rocky bluffs that were never submerged under the glaciers there. Very dramatic scenery. It covers a lot of different things. But a little wetter than outback, I must say. It does rain a little bit.
you are painting a very different picture than the picture that I have of Australia when I just do the default picture. What did you see, or what would you recommend seeing while you're in Tasmania?
The first thing I would talk about is I went out of curiosity today and I looked up Tasmania on Twitter to see what conversations are right now today. And the first thing I saw is that Tasmania is worth a visit in itself for Mona. And this is something that has changed museums. Mona is the Museum of Old and New Art, and it's in Hobart, which is the capital of Tasmania on the southern coast. And the only Hobart I know of, by the way, I'm a sucker for any town named Hobart, so I had to go to Hobart. But Hobart is a is a great place. It's right, Errol Flynn was born there in 1909. It's at the base of Mount Wellington, this massive mountain that they're talking about building a cable car to the top. And it's very controversial right now whether the local community wants that or not, or you still hike, or there's a kind of a battered road you can go up the backside. The cove and like the bay itself is, you know, lined with like these kind of very crusty fish and chips kind of places, and there's some very nice food and things like that. But in 2011, Hobart really changed, and it got on the international map because of Mona, what this tweet was about. Museum of Old and New Modern Art. There's a millionaire there by the name of David Walsh, and he created this in this kind of former working class neighborhood up the Derwent River from the center. And it's where he used to grow up. And he created this museum that you arrive to by ferry. And so you would take about 20 minutes to go from the center up this beautiful wide river that when it was first settled, there was whales in it. They would occasionally break ships and everyone would die because no one knew how to swim 100 feet to shore at that time. But you get to this site, and it's like kind of on a little kind of spit of land of sorts, and there's a vineyard down the backside if you happen to see it, but there's just kind of a glob building, and you're going, well, where's the museum? And it was built underground in the sandstone, and it is a very cutting-edge museum that I've been doing some research on museums in general. And basically, if you think about museums as a thing that we go and do when we travel a lot, museums are really kind of struggling right now how to be still relevant in this digital age when they have kind of digitized collections and people are traveling more about kind of local experiences, kind of a buzzword of eating food and going to sporting events and figuring out how to stay in neighborhoods with Airbnb. Where do museums fit in? So a lot of museums, that there's like museum nerds, the museum conferences, they're talking about what Mona did as a museum. It's so cutting edge that it's really changed how museums think about what they should do going ahead in the 21st century. So that's a long-winded way of saying that Mona is a place that people feel like they have to see. And that's making Tasmania an absolute place, even if they're going to, if they're coming, 70% of the people are coming from mainland Australia. But about 1 in 10 or so are coming from abroad, and they'll add on a few days from an Australia trip specifically to get to Hobart, specifically to see this museum. I could go on and on about it, and probably should say a little more about it. It's an unbelievable, unreal museum.
So you said old and new art. Is that including Aboriginal art or just classical art or...
Pretty much classical. It's whatever the whims of this very vocal, provocative leader of the museum, David Walsh, wants. And so he was into Egyptian art, so there's like 1,500-year-old Egyptian art there. And then you have the poop machine, to be undelicate about it. And it's a very modern installation of tubes and all this that once a day will poop. And it creates this gooey paste that does smell a little bit like something that you might not want to smell. And that's a modern installation of art.
And some people wonder why I'm not a big fan of modern art.
Well, see, the funny thing about it is you get off the ferry, you go up these steps, and the first thing you see is a door without a sign on it, nothing that labels it whatsoever, and a tennis court. And the reason they do that is they purposely want to underwhelm you. They want you to not think of them as a place that culture has to be taken too seriously, but that it just makes you curious. They said, I talked to the research curator there, who's hilarious, and said that we don't want to be experts. We just want to encourage curiosity. And so they don't have labels to any art. They don't want you to appreciate Picasso because it's Picasso. They want to appreciate the work. So they take all the labels away. You go down three stories by elevator or spiral staircase, and it feels like you're in an Egyptian crypt or tomb or something because it's all lined with sandstone. You're purposely getting lost. You stumble on things, and then you have a GPS device called the O, and it recognizes where you are. And if you want to find out more information about something, it'll give it to you, and it will tell you what this weird machine is, or why is there a ping pong table next to the rather sexualized versions of Red Riding Hood, or why is there a library in the middle of this room, and then you can go and use the library. And it gives you, one of my favorite things about it was actually, there was this one exhibit on the Vivian girls, which was done by a creepy self-artist in the Midwest in the U.S., I forgot his name. And when he died, he left behind like 15,000 drawings of kind of cartoonish drawings of young girls involved in some kind of civil war. And it was very strange. It's called the Vivian Girls. And I went through it and I was going, God, this is, I don't know what to make of this. And then I listened to it. And part of it was, is you could listen to a soundtrack while going through it. Mm-hmm. And they were songs that were made about the Vivian Girls by different bands. Some indie band I'd never heard of, Natalie Merchant, who was the singer for 10,000 Maniacs. And another was a name I cannot say on this family-friendly podcast because it's a profane name. It's a punk rock band. And is an 8-minute punk rock song called Vivian Girls. And so I played that. I went back and I looked at all the drawings with this music, and it was unlike any museum experience I had before. What they're trying to do is just change how we see things, make it more democratic in the sense that everyone's accessible to it. You don't have to have some art history. You like it or you don't. They're trying to make it a little bit less serious. It has been controversial, but it's really, like I said, it's making a lot of museums rethink about how they present whatever their topic is, and that's a good thing, and it's worth saying. I think even you would like it, Chris.
Well, it does seem like there's a fine line between we took down the labels so that you would just appreciate the art, and it's just poorly set up. But
that's true.
And one thing I should clarify, there are at least two Hobarts in the world, and the other one that I found is in your home state of Oklahoma, which we did not cover on the Oklahoma episode, but it is named after Garrett Hobart, the 24th Vice President of the United States. So,
gosh, that's amateur traveler pulling through right there. I love it.
And are there other things we should see in Hobart as long as we're in that neck of the woods?
Well, there's an interesting art display that's in the water itself. They have an outdoor art installation that you can walk along the bay. It's absolutely beautiful. You're looking out over these sailboats, and you see the hills in the distance on the other side. And they have these kind of installation art pieces that are sometimes embedded in the water just offshore, just right there, and with some description of it. But that's interesting to see because it's interesting to see, but also because it's a walk or kind of path that you can take and just see how beautiful it is. It's really hilly and gorgeous, and just the view of the water. The last one is where Errol Flynn was born, and he used to disguise the fact that he was from Hobart, Tasmania. He would tell people he was from Ireland when he was in Hollywood and stuff. But so Tasmania has been kind of slow to embrace this very controversial figure from Hollywood, but they end the walk with the Flynn, and they have the Flynn mystique, and it pulls no punches in that, showing all sides of that character. So it's a beautiful place. Mona dominates, but there's food and that art walk, and then other thing I would say is the Salamanca Market on weekends in that historic neighborhood right by the water. Great outdoor market with all kinds of things to eat and look for.
Okay, and Hobart is, as I recall, where Tasmania was first settled.
It isn't. It's the second oldest city.
It's the second oldest. Okay, that I couldn't remember.
The first oldest is its bitter rival to the north. And I spent a day there. It's called Launceston, and otherwise known as Lonnie. And they do not like each other too much, which I find very funny. In fact, one of the mayors of Launceston, they're trying to get a footy team in Tasmania, like Australian rules football. Mm-hmm. And some teams, I think Geelong, play some games in Launceston. And Hobart's so upset about it that they're trying to get another team to play there. And the mayor said, famously, of Launceston, that he would rather give up them hosting some footy games than to see Hobart get any at all. That's how this funny rivalry they have between these two cities. But Launceston's interesting because it's in the north. It's near the wine valley of the Tamar Valley. There's all kinds of wineries, a lot of Pinot Noirs and Chardonnays going on around there. And it's a historic town. It used to be a big beer town, so there's a brewery that's been there since the 1880s that you could tour called Bogues. But what I liked about it was it's the best food I had in Australia. They have a lot of seafood there, right, where the river, the South Esk River, comes by, and they have this great restaurant there where you can get in this old 1830s flour mill. They made it into a restaurant called Stillwater, and I had some of the greatest seafood I probably ever had. I'm not a foodie, but I'm telling you, the seafood there was remarkable. And a lot of people I know, like kind of in Melbourne, Sydney, will sometimes go on weekends away to Launceston specifically for the food. And also a block away from that, you go back into the Cataract Gorge, and suddenly you're in the bush. One block away from the center of Launceston, you get into the gorge. It's lined by the Stalarite Rock. It's kind of a narrow river walkway. You go back about the equivalent of a mile. There's this real Victorian area tea pavilion, peacocks running around, wallabies at dusk. Absolutely beautiful. And you feel like, until you get to that tea pavilion, you feel like you're in the middle of the bush. So Launceston was kind of a nice way to kind of bookend like this Tasmania in a sense. The two cities have a relationship to each other, which is sometimes a big rivalry, but really interesting. Really interesting on its own, too. I had a good time in Launceston.
And since we're starting to get into the bush and you'd been talking about walking, what time of year were you there then?
I was there in our spring, which is their fall. Mm-hmm. And it depends on what you want when you're going and things like that. If you go in their winter or summer, walks can be difficult. I mean, they have snow up in the mountains. They have snow potentially any time of year. But you go at that time of year, it can get really harsh in some parts of it, depending on what you're doing. I mean, if you're going to the city, it's easier to deal with. But I think that, like a lot of places, those curb seasons of spring and fall are great because it's not peak season. You don't have tons of visitors, and the weather's really great. I had rain two times a week, something like that.
Okay. And where to next?
Well, I think the main reason why I picked Tasmania and why a lot of Australians think about Tasmania is because of walking. And It's interesting. Americans, we call it hiking. They call it walking. And there was a study a number of years ago that counted the number of steps that various nations do a day. And Australians walk twice as much as Americans, which fascinates me because on one level, Australia is equally a grand, big nation, a car culture nation, if you will, as the United States is, in the sense that you have big metropolises that are spread out, a lot of them are, and vast distances between them. And so why is it that people are walking that much more? Well, a lot of them, that when they go on walking trips, and maybe it's because we call it hiking, I don't know, but the premier walking destination in Australia is Tasmania, and part of it is its compact area, but they have this real infrastructure up for walks, and you have these multi-day walks along the south coast and on the east coast and right through the heart of Tasmania, which I picked, which is their classic one, which is the Overland Track, which is about the equivalent of about 70 kilometers, 50 miles, and you go hut to hut. and they limit the number of people that can go in a day on the Overland Track. And this is kind of a little bit rugged of a walk, but I thought that I should do that to get a sense of really what's in the middle and the heart of this island of Tasmania.
And you say hut to hut. I'm sleeping in the huts, and so I'm not having to carry a tent, but are they providing food, or is it just shelter?
A couple different ways you can go. Mm-hmm. Overland Track allows 60 people a day to start, and you have to pay a pass, an Overland Track pass, to go. So they really limit the number of people because they do not want to do any kind of damage to the natural habitat of these animals and the forests and the mountains themselves. They're very, very careful about that. So they're limited. So they have a series of public huts that are spaced between like maybe 4 to 6 hour walk, depending on how you walk, all the way through the path, which goes from Cradle Mountain to the north down to the south to a place called Lake St. Clair. And there is these public huts you can stay at. And you have to take a tent, too, because sometimes one of them could be a little full, so you might end up camping. And they have these platforms that you can camp on. There's another series of private huts, which I did because I'm a bit of a wimp. And private huts enabled you to not worry about camping, no tents, but you also had showers. And you had food already at those places. You didn't have to think about all that. So you carry a little bit less. And I'm just enough of, I like camping, but going for 6 days, kind of rugged, you may be getting wet. I just like that sense of having, I'm just being honest, I liked having a shower. And it's all solar heated, solar powered. All of these huts are, and water's rainwater, and things like that. And they use the solar power to heat it, so there were warm showers at the end of the day. So that's Cradle Mountain Huts, and a lot of people do that. So it's very limited. You're going to have a lot of space to yourself out there.
And describe to me the terrain you're hiking through here. You mentioned moors on one side and coniferous forests. And
you go through all kinds of things I had never heard about, stringy bark trees and banksia plants and snowy peppermints and all this. And you learn very quickly about wombat droppings because they're all over the place. Wombats are these funny, hilarious little animals that leave where they've been in these stacked cube of feces, essentially, and it's all over the place. And you think you're sick of it, believe me, in like 3 minutes because it's all over the place. So you're seeing a rise. You're going up and down over these rocky mountains, and you look over and you see a string of kind of glacial lakes in the distance. And then sometimes it will be overcast, and you can't see for 20 feet. And that's going to happen on a walk because you're going to get some of these climate conditions. So the first day is actually most famous when you go past Cradle Mountain, which is this massive rock top peak, one of the highest part of the walk. And then you go up past these lakes and over a pass and through these moors, and you see these kind of button grass and cushion plants, these kind of bright green. And you go up to this mountain, and I was talking to someone that had been like 30 years before, and they said, the last time I was here, I couldn't see my feet. And it was amazing to me, the clarity that I had that day, but that the next day or 2 days later, you might not be able to see it. So within my 6 days, I had a couple days that were foggy and I couldn't see much, or it was raining a little bit, and then some days that you could just see forever. So you really see, it depends on the weather you're having and what part of the track you're at. But to me, it was even beyond this place, which is absolutely beautiful, and you're out in the middle of nowhere. You're not going to see, I didn't even notice a plane going by, for example. Like in some places you might once in 3 days hear a plane or something like that. Nothing, no semblance of the modern world, so to speak. Certainly no cell phone connection or anything like that. And it was really about looking more close at these waterfalls and at these they have like thousands of mushrooms in Australia. Only 10% of the mushrooms in Australia, and many of them are in Tasmania, only 10% have names. There's so many different kinds. You see these bright red and bright yellow and translucent and different colored kind of fungi basically sprouting from the middle of trees and tops of fallen logs and stuff all over the place, as you see a lot here in the Pacific Northwest, actually. And I just amazed the amount of color and exotic detail that was just right around you, regardless of the weather.
And you mentioned the sounds from your trip, and you're in Tasmania, so I have to ask, did you hear at night the Tasmanian devil?
No. The Tasmanian devil right now is going through all kinds of this epidemic. There's some tumors that they have developed in recent years. Yeah. The population has gone down dramatically. Like, I think 80% of the populations are lost. So to see a Tasmanian devil in the wild is almost unicorn-like right now. Hmm. That isn't to say that they're not around, because there are these conservation centers that are trying to give them space but track their numbers and make sure that they are not they don't have this illness that is very infectious. And the problem with Tasmanian devils are they're these little gangly creatures. They are predators. Mm-hmm. They have very strong jaws. They can bite through bone and actually.
But I think of them more as scavengers, aren't they? Don't they eat a lot of carrion?
That's what I meant to say. Sorry. They bite each other while eating. It's part of their just kind of their
table
habit.
Manners. Yeah.
Yeah, their table manners. Tasmanian devil table manners are not the best. And so what happens is that it can lead to this infection. And they don't know where it's from. But there has been a problem with foxes in Australia in general, and they're really bad for wildlife such as Tasmanian devils and things. That hasn't become a problem yet in Tasmania, but if it did, it could be very damaging for paddy melons, which are kind of small kangaroos, and wallabies, which are slightly bigger but miniature kangaroos, so to speak. It could be very bad for those populations because they would be going for similar food sources, and it could be a problem. But they had this poison that went out a number of years ago that some people have suggested may have had something to do with this, to go after the foxes. And this was trying to keep any fox population from ever growing in Tasmania. And for whatever reason, it's never happened. The foxes haven't been a problem yet in Tasmania. But that could be. Who knows? But I did go to a conservation center for the Tasmanian devil and got to see close-up Tasmanian devils, and they fed them. But this was not in a natural setting. This was a scientific survey of them.
Well, and the reason why I ask is I remember when my kids were little, they would watch Kratz Creatures, and the sound of those at night was the strange and eerie sound. You understand why the people who created the Tasmanian devil on the Warner Brothers cartoons, where they got that sound from that they used there.
Yeah, that's not the best sound, probably. I have that the population used to be about 150,000, and 80% of them have been lost. And this is in a really short
period of time.
Last 20 years.
And then you mentioned the foxes and then poisoning the foxes. Just in case anyone didn't know, I think this, again, is a very well-educated audience here, but the foxes, and as well as dingoes and rabbits in the mainland, all being introduced by Europeans later on, so not indigenous to Tasmania.
The dingoes apparently were introduced by the Aboriginals before.
They were introduced later, right? You are correct. Right.
That's true. That's why you have to be careful what you introduce for certain.
Yeah, and if you want more about that, watch The Rabbit Proof Fence as a movie here.
I just saw that. Yeah, that's a great. There's a lot of different Australian movies that are really great, just looking at Australia in general, that are fantastic and sometimes aren't as big and mainstream here, other than Crocodile Dundee. There is a Tasmanian movie, not necessarily the best in the world, with Willem Dafoe, about the Tasmanian tiger.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And they came out. This is an extinct animal that used to exist. It's like one of those animals like the platypus that looks like it was just assorted pieces put together, but they went extinct about 70 or 80 years ago.
You mentioned you had a public option limited to 60 people a day starting, and a private option. That was the one with the jacuzzi and the butler, as I recall. What are the various costs of those?
If you take the Cradle Mountains, you're going to pay a couple $1,000s to do it for 6 days, including all your meals, guides, staying at the places, and transportation to and from.
That's the private?
The place. Yes. And then the other one, you're paying for the Overland Track Pass is about 160 Australian, and the National Park Pass 30, it's about 190. So that's about 175 or so dollars to get out there. The huts themselves are part of it, and so in camping as well. But you would obviously have the costs of packing all your things,
sure,
food for the trip and stuff to consider, but considerably cheaper if you use the public huts.
Excellent. Where to next?
Well, I would say that another thing that people do associate, for better or worse, and for worse for many years, with Tasmania, is that it was Van Diemen's Land. And a lot of people, when they think of Australia, you think of, oh, it's an island of convicts. And the country is considered that part of their history, that they were founded essentially by convicts from Britain, as a stain. It's called the stain there. And that's true of all of Australia, but particularly connected with Tasmania. I mean, Tasmania at a time, like if you go back to like the mid-1800s, something like 3% of like New South Wales, the state that Sydney is in, were convicts at that point, whereas it was about 40% of Tasmania. And so the number of convicts that were there, the association with the worst prisons, the most dreaded destination if you were a repeat offender of a convict was to get into Tasmania, which was called Van Diemen's Land at that time. So Van Diemen's Land, there's all these like epic ballad poems and stuff, a lot of it linked with the Irish that were written in the 1800s that was like, oh my gosh, Tasmania, I mean, Van Diemen's Land. It was like this ultimate disastrous place you could go to. So Tasmania in particular is linked with that side of the history, and that affects how we can see it today. Because one of its more famous sites is called the Port Arthur Historic Site, which was a penitentiary that was founded in the 1820s, and it was active to 1877, mm-hmm. So about 50 years or so that it was active. It's in the southeastern corner of Tasmania. It was very remote, and that's why it was put there. You had to go by sea. It was a very rocky outcrop of islands you had to navigate through to get into this, what was actually a pretty calm bay, quite beautiful now. But you can drive there an hour and a half from Hobart now. You certainly could in the 1800s. So it was very, very much like kind of almost an Alcatraz, even though it was not an island or something.
I think almost like Devil's Island more, you know, just being so remote and far into the earth.
I went there. I felt like it was important to see some of that side of the history of Tasmania. And it's so much this and that in terms of, it's a site that Robert Hughes, he wrote a book called The Fatal Shore about this whole era. Yeah, and he calls it Australia's Dachau, linking to a concentration camp, which is a bit not exactly the right analogy, but that's how much it weighs in some people's. But you get there, and it looks like a gorgeous English village. You see this kind of Gothic church and these wonderful quarters. There's two buildings that were part of the prison. They're actually kind of beautiful architecturally, right along this gorgeous cove and just absolutely fascinating setting. There's gardens and beautiful green meadows and things like that. So you're going, what? This is Port Arthur? And so I talked to people there, and you get some of this from Hughes' book, too, that it wasn't necessarily meant outright to terrify, and that they were honestly created that to try to reform people, which was a very unusual concept at that time, because until the 1800s, prisons were places to just, you felt that the people were inherently bad and they would go to prison. But starting in like around the time, like Philadelphia Eastern State Penitentiary, for example, used the notion of solitary confinement as a way that was better than whipping people in terms of reforming them. The hope was that you could reform these people, and that was very much part of the plan in Port Arthur. And so, though it sounds terrible, obviously, to be in a prison and be in solitary confinement for 23 hours a day and be 1 hour active a day by yourself in a high-walled garden or something like that, the goal was, as many attest and the site talks about, was to hopefully to reform these people. So there was actually worse prisons, some more notorious prisons in Tasmania than Port Arthur, though Port Arthur is sometimes seen as the worst of the worst, but it's something that's still debated a little bit.
Well, and the other thing, too, is when we think about the people who were sent to Australia or to Tasmania, many of them were for just petty crimes, were just poor trying to get by. You didn't take the serial murderer, for instance, and send him to Australia. You hung him, the way that justice worked at the time. So
part of this all happened because the Americans got independence, because they couldn't send people they could to the colonies, the American colonies anymore. And so, but it was founded very differently, because American colonies were gradual and you did have all these different settlements in different places. But there, the first boat of convicts came specifically to found the place. You know, 1788, they arrive at Sydney Cove with nothing there for them. How crazy and what an amazing achievement, really, that Australia came from that. And then on down to Tasmania. But Tasmania's link to this is far greater. The site itself was, I must say, is remarkably preserved and fascinating. They have, in one of the prisons, they have plays, and they have a play of a true story of someone, an Irishman, who threw a rock at the English king. This is a true story. And hit the king and was sent off to Van Diemen's Land. And he did a hunger protest, refused to eat. And they did a 16-minute play about this guy arriving at Van Diemen's Land in the prison. I thought that was just fantastic use of space, and it was really interesting just to see it in the place that it was inspired from.
Excellent. What surprised you about Tasmania?
Tasmania is complex. I'm sitting here trying to talk about this. People that have lived their lives in Tasmania are divided about it, and it's kind of this Tasmanian complex, so to speak. And that what I mean is that it is beautiful. there is great food, there's great people and events and things like that happening, but it often feels like it's astray from the nation itself. Bill Bryson's book, In a Sunburnt Country, mm-hmm. which I think is an absolutely wonderful travelogue book on Australia, which is hilarious, and you just filled with wonder. I'm just highlighting page after page when I read that and just thinking, my goodness, what a fascinating place. And in fact, he says so. The theme of his book is at the beginning, he's flying in Australia and he realizes with a sigh that he doesn't remember who the prime minister is. And he says someone out there somewhere should be in charge of remembering who the prime minister of Australia is. And his point is that in the Western world, at least, in Europe and in the States, we don't pay attention that much to Australia. It registers on us, but we don't think about it on a daily basis. And the last line of the book is, you see, Australia is an interesting place. It truly is. And that really is all I'm saying. Now, the reason why I bring that up is he's trying to give attention to something that people maybe take for granted or that's down under and far away. Well, Tasmania is down under of down under. Mm-hmm. It has the same relationship that perhaps Australia has with us, with Australia. And so there's Tasmania has this kind of funny complex in a way. There's a hilarious book that I got called The Tasmania Tipping Point that came out last fall. It was done by Griffith Review. They do books there in Australia. And this one was all about Tasmania. And I was reading these essays, and they talk about David Walsh, who was the person behind the Mona Museum we're talking about earlier, said, we Taswegians, as he said, know that we aren't special, but paradoxically, we think we have something to prove. And someone else named Cassandra Pivas says, I can't live anywhere else but this beautiful, empty terminus of the world. And someone else, they described the shape of Tasmania, and they said, it's a heart. And then a friend said, well, it could be a bum. And so they have this funny paradox of how they see Tasmania. It's like how we feel like they are trying to have their like coming out party, essentially, right now. And that's what's been so pivotal about things like the Mona, or that they have a whiskey from Hobart that actually won an award for the best whiskey recently in Chicago. They have these funny things that are happening that are registering, and it feels like finally that they are going to get on the radar, because historically people who go to Tasmania are going on their second or third trip to Australia, if at all. But it's starting to feel like this finally is their moment. So if there's something that surprised me, it's just this kind of embedded culture of kind of a wait and see, like, is it really happening kind of thing, which is very playful because the people absolutely love Tasmania. And everyone that I met in New South Wales and Victoria said, oh, you're going to Tassie? You're going to Tassie? Oh, you're going to love it. People have that reaction, but it feels a little bit kind of lost, the down under, away from the limelight too. So I'm still working it out, Chris. It's hard.
Well, you have spent a lot of your life, a significant portion, as a guidebook writer. If you were writing the Tasmania guidebook, what is one tip that people should know?
I think that it is a huge walking destination. They have 60 short walks that are organized around the island that are they're mapped out clearly so that you can see this very rugged coastlines going into the forest over mountains. And it's very, very much part of its culture, the walks. You have a lot of these bigger walks. Australia has something called the Great Walks of Australia, and I forget how many there are, like 8 or 9 or something like that. Half of them are in Tasmania. So it is very much a place that you do want to bring your hiking boots to. And whether it's just a 2-hour hike, like up that Cataract Gorge in downtown Launceston I was talking about earlier, or off the coast, along the rugged coast as a day trip from around Port Arthur Historic Site in the southeastern corner, or a multi-day trip, whether it's camping or a hut-to-hut, think about Tasmania, getting out into it, because that's how Tasmanians love it. That's how Australians look at it. And we really see it differently from close up and out with all those fungi.
Excellent. You're standing in the prettiest spot you saw in Tasmania. Where are you standing and what are you looking at?
The first thing that comes to mind is the middle of the Overland Track, rainy day. There's a tree, and in the middle of a tree is a cross that says, Ranger Fergie. And it was a little tribute to a former ranger in the park that was instrumental in helping kind of create and conserve some of these, preserve some of the trails itself, and really loved this spot. And you hear this roar that Ranger Fergie apparently really liked. And you go off the trail a little bit towards this roar, and suddenly through this thick, it's the Myrtle Rainforest there, and you look down and you see this stack of rocks just completely under this waterfall, just thundering down. And it just it kind of confused my sense of dimensions because it looked like the waterfall was going under your feet because it was such an extreme angle of where this ended to where the water was. And it was built on these kind of altering massive boulders of dolerite rock that looked like a kid put it together. And it was just so dramatic because of how it just broke the dimensions in a way. I don't know if I've ever approached a waterfall as dramatically as that. And somewhere out there in the middle of a overland track, if not that spot, would be another spot that I would be the most scenic, beautiful view I had.
Excellent. Any language tips for Tasmania?
It helps to leave your sense of English at the door, so to speak. there's some strong accents going on. I'm just joking, really. There's some funny expressions. There's abbreviations for everything. Sunnies for sunglasses, like you see in the rest of Australia. Everything is abbreviated, which I find humorous. And so I try to collect as many abbreviations as much as possible and funny little expressions that'll come up. But you can understand everyone. They do speak English in Tasmania. Or so I've been told.
The most memorable local you met?
Well, I met Bert Spinks, first one to come to mind. He was one of the guides on the trip. Young guy. He has long, stringy blonde hair. He grew a beard, so he said that because some people mistook him for a woman. And he's this young 25-year-old guy. He's as proud of his Tasmania as he possibly have. And he's a poet. And he has a site called A Field Guide to Falling in Love in Tasmania. And he's written poems on Tasmania. He has like events in Launceston about storytelling and things like that. And there's kind of a timeless quality about him. And I really enjoy talking about walking with him and about why it's okay to get muddy boots is what I learned from him. You might complain every step is soggy after a while. It gets wet out there a little bit. And he talks about what a cheap price that is to pay for access to a place that is lucky to still be there. Because Tasmania has had quite a controversy over some areas being forested and losing these old growth forests, and that this area is still preserved. The price of muddy boots, that's very small. So Bert would be one that comes to mind.
Excellent.
Oh, I'm going to mention another one. Mm-hmm. I mentioned this woman who's in her 60s in Launceston. It was hilarious. And she talked, and this is a story that will come and go all over Tasmania. She was talking about how I said, well, when did your family come here? So, well, she started talking about her great-great-grandparents, and her great-great-grandfather came as a convict, and he apparently liked to reveal himself to people. He exposed himself, immediately got the lash for that, and his great-grandmother was actually in for larceny. And so the reason why I say this, and they found true love together, I guess, somewhere, and I don't know which penal colony or what period that is. The reason why I bring that up is that part of history is very much linked to today, and a lot of people have been there for multi-generations. In fact, at Port Arthur, people told me, yeah, sometimes people come in here so proud and beaming with excitement because they had an ancestor that was there. This is new for Tasmania and for Australia, that people would have some sense of pride, or they wouldn't hide their past. And so This woman that I met, who was fascinating and hilarious and spoke like a sailor with all every kind of new use of profanity that I couldn't imagine, was really funny because of how open she was about that. Fascinating. It said a lot about the things I had read about in Robert Hughes' book. But here you are talking to people that are linked very much to that historical origin of the place.
Right. Well, it brings whole new meaning to the term penal colony.
Yes, that's right.
Before we get to our last three questions, what else should people know before they go to Tasmania?
If you go to Australia for the first time, you might consider it because you can get cheap flights from Melbourne and Sydney that are a lot cheaper than going out to Alice Springs to see Uluru or going up to Darwin. I'm not putting down those places. Those are dreamy, once-in-a-lifetime places that you would have to see in the middle of the outback. I'm just saying that in terms of proximity and cost, it may be closer and more manageable than you realize in terms of a couple-hour flight from Sydney or something like that. And I think that increasingly people with like the promotion of Mona and the way people are talking about Mona, this museum, look at it as a city break, going for a few days and have a little bit of walk. I think that it really tells another side to Australia because it feels and looks so much different, but it's so close.
Right.
So I really liked it.
Excellent. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in Tasmania.
Oh gosh, sheep poo. I'm going on these country roads and you see this little sign handmade. It says sheep poo and there's a little box next to it. It's like an honor system and you buy the sheep poo. Hopefully you brought a little bag to take in it.
As you need. Okay.
Yeah, used as fertilizer. I mean, it's things like that. There's a sense of do-it-yourself a little bit like that, which is really fun. And I didn't get any sheep poo, so I got to go back.
And finish the sentence. You really know you're in Tasmania when what?
You look and you see rocks that look like concrete French fries, some of them called it, on the top of mountains, kind of cube-like rocks. And then the fog comes and you can't see anything. You look down your leg and there's a little leech you have to flick off. And then you realize that it doesn't matter whatsoever whether you can see that rock or if that leech does get on you for a second, because there is, I don't know, it goes back to what Bert says. There's this just absolute appeal of having your boots muddy. I don't know of any place I was more happy to have my boots muddied than out on the overland track.
Excellent. And if you had to summarize Tasmania in just three words?
I would ask for four. I might call it down under is down under. The second down under is closed up, so it's three words. It just goes back to that notion that it is down under feels like this other world that's far and remote and wild and wondrous. And this is kind of doubling it up, the down under of down under.
Excellent. And the only clarification I would leave for people is if you're looking for the General Tommy Franks Museum, that's in Hobart, Oklahoma, not in Hobart, Tasmania. But you can learn more about Oklahoma also by listening to the episode we did with Robert. Robert has also been on the show talking about the Far East of Russia. And thanks so much for coming on and talking about Tasmania. Where can people read more about your travels?
I write on my site, which is Read on Travel, R-E-I-D, on travel.com. And over at the National Geographic Traveler's website, I wrote recently about walking, which connects me very deeply to my Tasmania experience, too.
Excellent. Robert, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
In the news today, I do have one news item that caught my eye, and that is that TripAdvisor announced their list of the world's top landmarks and parks. And this is based on reviews. And I love TripAdvisor. Big fan of TripAdvisor, and they pay my salary part-time because I work for them 2-3 days a week. But I don't find that they're the most authoritative resource necessarily for these sort of lists, but I find it interesting because they do tell us where people go and what they like. Now, I love them for hotels and wouldn't think about booking a hotel without looking at them. But here's their list for the top U.S. landmarks. The top landmark is Gettysburg National Military Park, followed by the Lincoln Memorial, the Golden Gate Bridge, Alcatraz, the U.S. Arizona Memorial, Cloud Gate in Chicago, Vietnam Veterans Memorial, the New York Public Library, the Cathedral of St. John the Baptist in Savannah, and the Korean War Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. I think I've seen all but two of those. I need to get to Savannah, and I don't think I've seen the Korean War Veterans Memorial yet. And then the top 10 world landmarks, Machu Picchu, the Grand Mosque in Abu Dhabi, the Taj Mahal, the Grand Cathedral and Mosque in Cordoba, Spain, St. Peter's Basilica, Angkor Wat, the Bayonne Temple, Church of Our Savior of Spilled Blood in St. Petersburg, again Gettysburg National Military Park in Pennsylvania, ancient city walls in Dubrovnik. It looks like I've got a lot of travel ahead of me. I've only been to three of those, and that includes Cordoba, Vatican City, and of course, again, Gettysburg. I'm curious how many of those you have been to. Check out the list and then leave your comments on this episode of The Amateur Traveler. Or which is the one that you most want to go to? From that whole list there, for instance, I think Angkor Wat is probably the place that I'm most anxious to see next. They also had top U.S. parks and top world parks. Top U.S. parks, Garden of the Gods in Colorado Springs, Central Park in New York City, Millennium Park in Chicago, Highline Park in New York City. That is a wonderful little park. Boston Public Gardens, Golden Gate Park, Balboa Park in San Diego, Bryant Park in New York City, Forsyth Park in Savannah, and Falls Park on the Ready in Greenville, South Carolina. And I haven't been to the last two, and I have never heard of the last one in Greenville, so I'm curious about that one. And then the top 10 world parks, Stanley Park in Vancouver, Canada, a very good choice. Garden of the Gods in Colorado Springs, Central Park in New York City, Millennium Park in Chicago, the Highline in New York City, Kings Park and Botanic Gardens in Perth, Parc Güell in Barcelona, again a very good choice, Ibirapuera Park in Sao Paulo, Brazil, Retiro Park in Madrid, Spain, and Luxembourg Gardens in Paris, France. For a link to that whole list, check out the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. In news of the community, I heard from Casey, who had some comments on the Travel to Denver episode. A few clarifications. Washington Park, there's no square in the name. And I don't know whether our guest called it Washington Square Park or I did, but I could see where I might do that and use the name of the park both in San Francisco and in New York, which has the word square in it. Nice views of the mountains, but not the skyline. If you want views of the downtown skyline and mountains, that is City Park, where the Museum of Nature and Science is located. Tattered Cover, great indie bookstore, but no longer in Cherry Creek. They moved to Colfax. Red Rocks, great place to listen to live music, but if you are short, wear boots or something with heels, as sometimes hard to see, and don't go if you cannot handle marijuana smoke. Food, great tons of Mexican food. Check La Popular near downtown for authentic Mexican food. Also a large Ethiopian community, so East Colfax has lots of excellent Ethiopian food. True Denver experiences, jog 2.5 miles around Washington Park. Yeah, for those of us who are flatlanders, jogging at Denver's elevation may take a little while. Rent bicycles and go for a ride on Cherry Creek Trail. Wander Colfax around York and Josephine is a good area. Closer day trips, Mount Evans Road and Golden Gate State Park. Casey, thanks so much. And that's left as a comment on the Travel to Denver episode. Again, if you have any comment on any episode like Casey does that adds value to that episode, go ahead and put it on that episode where people who go there, where people who discover that episode can also discover your insight. With that, we're going to end this episode of The Amateur Traveler. Don't forget to come with us to Morocco. Look again at the Amateur Traveler site for the book travel tab at the top. If you have any questions, feel free to send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com or do what Casey did and leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Chris2X. And as always, thanks so much for listening.